on his forehead, not unlike Nimitz, the MP's little pet kitten's hesitant tongue. When the MP still had the kitten, before the mysterious period where the kitten disappeared, and the garbage disposal wouldn't run right for days, and the MP sat hungover with his notebook at the kitchen table, with his blonde head in his hands. Just sat there for several days. And Gately's mom went around pale as hell, and wouldn't go near the kitchen sink for days, and rushed to the bathroom when Gately finally asked, what was the deal with the garbage disposal? And where was Nimitz? When Gately gets his eyelids unstuck, though, the tongue is not even close to being Nimitz's. The Wraith is back, right by the bed, dressed like before, and blurred at the edges in the hat-shadowed spill of hallway light, and except now with him is another, younger, way more physically fit Wraith, in kind of faggy biking shorts and a U.S. tank top, who's leaning way over Gately's railing and fucking licking Gately's forehead with a rough little tongue. And as Gately reflexively strikes out at the guy's map, no man put his tongue on D.W. Gately and lived. He has just enough time to realize the Wraith's breath has no warmth to it, or smell, before both Wraiths vanish, and a blue-forked bolt of pain from his sudden striking out sends him back against his hot pillow with an arched spine and a tube, impeded scream, his eyes rolling back into the dove-colored light of whatever isn't quite sleep. His fever is way worse, and his little snatches of dreams have a dismantled cubist aspect he associates in memory with childhood flu. He dreams, he looks in a mirror and sees nothing, and keeps trying to clean the mirror with his sleeve. One dream consists only of the color blue, too vivid, like the blue of a pool. An unpleasant smell keeps coming up his throat. He's both in a bag and holding a bag. Visitors flit in and out, but never ferocious Francis or Joelle Van D. He dreams there's people in his room, but he's not one of them. He dreams he's with a very sad kid, and they're in a graveyard digging some dead guy's head up, and it's really important, like continental emergency important, and Gately's the best digger, but he's wicked hungry, like irresistibly hungry, and he's eating with both hands out of huge economy-sized bags of corporate snacks so he can't really dig, while it gets later and later, and the sad kid is trying to scream at Gately that the important thing was buried in the guy's head, and to divert the continental emergency, to start digging the guy's head up before it's too late. But the kid moves his mouth, but nothing comes out. And Joelle Van D appears, with wings and no underwear, and asks if they knew him, the dead guy with the head. And Gately starts talking about knowing him, even though deep down he feels panic because he's got no idea who they're talking about, while the sad kid holds something terrible up by the hair and makes the face of somebody shouting in panic, "Too late!" She'd come out of the St. E's doors and turned right for the quick walk back up to Ennett, and a grotesquely huge woman, whose hose bulged with stubble, and whose face and head were four times larger than the largest woman Joelle had ever seen, had grabbed her arm at the elbow and said she was sorry to be the one to tell her, but that unbeknownst to her she was in almost mind-boggling danger. It took rather a while for Joelle to look her up and down. "This is supposed to be news?" But that night's next AM found Gately and Fackelman still there in Fackelman's little corner, belts around their arms, arms and noses red from scratching, still at it, the ingestion, on a hell of a tear, cooking up and getting off and eating M&Ms when they could find their mouths with their hands, moving like men deep underwater, heads wobbling on strengthless necks, the empty room's ceiling sky blue and bulging, and under it, hanging on the wall overhead to their right, the apartment's upscale TP's viewer, on a recursive slow-mo loop of some creepy thing Fackelman liked, that was just serial shots of flames from brass lighters, kitchen matches, pilot lights, birthday candles, votive candles, pillar candles, birch shavings, Bunsen burners, etc., that Fackelman had got from Kite, who, just before dawn, had come out dressed and declined to get high with them, and coughed nervously, and announced he had to leave for a few days or more for a totally key and unmissable software trade show in a different area code. Not knowing Gately now knew he knew Fackelman already to be dead, with Kite then trying to leave discreetly with every piece of hardware he owned in his arms, including the non-portable DEC, trailing cables. Then, a bit later, as the AM light intensified yellowly, and made both Gately and Fackelman curse the fact that the curtains had been stripped and pawned, as they continued to hunch and cook and shoot at maybe 0830 hours, Pamela Hoffman Jeep was up and vomiting briskly and applying mousse against the workaday day, calling Gately honey and her night errand, and asking if she'd done anything last night she'd have to explain to anybody today. Kind of an AM routine in their relationship. Applying blush and drinking her standard anti-hangover breakfast.
377.
And watching Gately and Fackelman's chins fall and rise at slightly different underwater rates. The smell of her perfume and high Retzen mints hung in the bare room long after she'd bid them both ciao bello. As the AM sun got higher and intolerable, instead of taking action and nailing a blanket or something over the window, they opted instead to obliterate the reality of the eye-scalding light and began truly binging on blues, flirting with an OD. They scaled Fackelman's Mount Dilaudid at a terrible clip. Fackelman was, by nature, a binger. Gately was typically more like a maintenance user. He rarely went on a classic-type binge, which meant plunking down in one place with an enormous stash and getting loaded over and over again for long periods without moving. But when he did start a binge, he might as well have been strapped to the snout of a missile, for all the control he had over length or momentum. Fackelman was having at the mountain of 10-milligram blues like there was no tomorrow. Every time Gately even started to bring up the issue of how Faxter had come by such a huge, blue haul of the substance, trying, maybe, to invite Fackelman to confront the reality of his trouble by describing it, like Fackelman would cut him off with a soft, "That's a goddamn lie." This was pretty much all Fackelman would ever say, when loaded, even in response to things like questions. You have to picture all the binge's verbal exchanges as occurring, like, very slowly, oddly distended, as if the time were honey.
"Serious fucking stash you managed to come by somehow right here, but that's a goddamn lie. Man, I just hope Gwen Dean, the C's, got the phone today out there, man, instead of Whitey. No business getting done out of here today, I don't think. It's a goddamn lie. That's for sure, Facts. It's a goddamn lie. Facts. The Faxter. Count Faxula. Goddamn lie."
After a while, in all the distension, it got to be like a joke. Gately would haul his big head upright and try to allege the roundness of the planet, the three-dimensionality of the phenomenal world, the blackness of all black dogs.
"It's a goddamn lie."
They found it increasingly funny. After every exchange like this, they laughed and laughed. Each exhalation of laughter seemed to take several minutes. The ceiling and the window's light receded. Fackelman wet his pants. This was even funnier. They watched the pool of urine spread out against the hardwood floor, changing shape, growing curved arms, exploring the fine oak floor. The rises and valleys and little seams. It might have gotten later, and then early AM again. The entertainment cartridge's myriad small flames were reflected in the spreading puddle, so that soon Gately could watch without taking his chin off his chest. When the phone rang, it was just a fact. The ringing was like an environment, not a signal. The fact of its ringing got more and more abstract. Whatever a ringing phone might signify was like totally overwhelmed by the overwhelming fact of its ringing. Gately pointed this out to Fackelman. Fackelman vehemently denied it. At some point, Gately tried to stand and was rudely assaulted by the floor and wet his own pants. The phone rang and rang. At another point, they got interested in rolling different colors of peanut M&Ms into the puddles of urine and watching the colored dye corrode and leave a vampire white football of M&M in a nimbus of bright dye. The intercom's buzzer, to the luxury apartment complex's glass doors downstairs, sounded, overwhelming both of them with the fact of its sound. It buzzed and buzzed. They discussed wishing it would stop, the way you discuss wishing it would stop raining. It became the ICBM of binges. The substance seemed inexhaustible. Mount Dilaudid changed shapes, but never really much shrank, that they could see. It was the first and only time, ever, that Gately IV'd narcotics so many times in one arm that he ran out of arm vein and had to switch to the other arm. Fackelman was no longer coordinated enough to help him tie off and boot. Fackelman kept making a string of chocolatey drool appear and distend almost down to the floor. The acidity of their urine was corroding the apartment's hardwood floor's finish in an observable way. The puddle had grown many arms, like a Hindu god. Gately couldn't quite tell if the urine had explored its way almost back to their feet or if they were already sitting in urine. Fackelman would see how close to the surface of the pond of their mixed piss he could get the tip of the string of spit before he sucked it back up and in. The little game had an intoxicating aura of danger to it. The insight that most people like play danger but don't like real-life danger hit Gately like an epiphany. It took him gallons of viscous time to try and articulate the insight to Fackelman so that Fackelman could give it the imprimatur of a denial. Eventually the buzzer stopped. The phrase, "more tattoos than teeth," also kept going through Gately's head as it bobbed the head, even though he had no idea where the phrase came from or who it was supposed to refer to. He hadn't been to Billerica Minimum yet. He was on bail. That Whitey Sorkin had bonded. The taste of the M&Ms couldn't cut the weirdly sweet medical taste of hydromorphone in Gately's mouth. He watched an old stovetop burner's crown of blue flame shimmer in the shine of the urine. During a ruddled sunset light period, Fackelman had had a small convulsion and a bowel movement in his pants, and Gately hadn't had the coordination to go to Fackelman's side during the seizure to help and just be there. He had the nightmarish feeling that there was something crucial he had to do, but had forgot what it was. 10 milligram injections of the Blue Bayou kept the feeling at bay for shorter and shorter periods. He'd never heard of somebody having a convulsion from an OD, and Fackelman had indeed seemed to bounce to his version of back. The sun outside the big windows seemed to go up and down, like a yo-yo. They ran out of the distilled water Fackelman had in the mixing bowl, and Fackelman took a cotton and sopped up candy-dyed urine off the floor and cooked up with urine. Gately appeared to himself to be repulsed by this, but there was no question of trying to get to the stripped kitchen for the distilled water bottle. Gately was tying off his right arm with his teeth now. His left was so useless. Fackelman smelled very bad. Gately nodded out into a dream where he was on a Beverly Needham bus, whose side said, "Paragon Bus Lines, the Gray Line." In his stuporous recall over 4 years later in St. Elizabeth's, he realizes that this bus is the bus from the dream that wouldn't end and wouldn't go anywhere, but has the sickening realization that the connection between the two buses is itself a dream, or is in a dream, and it's now that his fever returns to new heights, and his line on the heart monitor gets a funny little hitch, like a serration at the first and third nodes, which makes an amber light flash at the nurse's station down the hall. When the buzzer sounded again, they were watching the Flames film late at night. Now, poor old Pamela Hoffman Jeep's voice came to them through the intercom. The intercom and apartment complex front door's unlocker button were all the way across the living room by the apartment door. The ceiling bulged and receded. Fackelman had made his hand into the shape of a claw and was studying the claw in the light of the teepee's flames. Mount Allotted was badly caved in on one side. A disastrous avalanche into Lake Huron was a possibility. PHJ sounded drunk as a nook. She said to let her in. She said she knew they were in there. She used party as a verb several times. Fackelman was whispering that it was a lie. Gately remembers he actually had to prod himself in the bladder to feel if he had to go to the bathroom. His unit felt small and icy cold against his leg in the wet jeans. The ammoniac smell of urine and the breathing ceiling and drunk distant female voice. Gately reached in the dark for the bars of his playpen, grasped them with pudgy fists, hauled himself to his feet. His rising was more like the floor lowering. He wobbled like a toddler. The apartment floor below him fainted right, left, circling for an opening to attack. The luxury windows hung with starlight. Fackelman had made his claw come alive into a spider and was letting the spider climb slowly down his chest area. The starlight was smeary. There were no distinct stars. Everything out of the line of fire of the cartridge viewer was dark as a pocket. The buzzer sounded angry, and the voice pathetic. Gately put his foot out in the direction of the buzzer. He heard Fackelman telling his hands, claws, spider it was witnessing the birth of an empire. Then, when Gately put his foot down, there was nothing there. The floor dodged his foot and rushed up at him. He caught a glimpse of bulged ceiling, and then the floor caught him in the temple. His ears belled. The impact of the floor against him shook the whole room. A box of laminates teetered and fell, and fanned clear laminates all over the wet floor. The viewer fell off the wall and cast ruddled flames on the ceiling. The floor jammed itself against Gately, pressing in tight, and he grayed out with his scrunched face toward Fackelman and the windows beyond, with Fackelman holding the spider out in midair at him for his inspection.
Oh, for Christ's sake, then. I was in two scenes. What else is in there, I do not know. In the first scene, I'm going through a revolving door. You know, around in this glass revolving door. And going around out, as I go in, is somebody I know but apparently haven't seen for a long time. Because the recognition calls for a shocked look. And the person sees me and gives an equally shocked look. We're supposedly formerly very close and now haven't seen each other in the longest time, and the meeting is a random chance. And instead of going in, I keep going around in the door to follow the person out, which person is also still revolving in the door to follow me in, and we whirl in the door like that for several whirls.
Question.
The actor was male. He wasn't one of Jim's regulars. But the character I recognize in the door is Epicene.
Question.
Hermaphroditic. Androgynous. It wasn't obvious that the character was supposed to be a male character. I assume you can identify. The other had the camera bolted down inside a stroller or bassinet. I wore an incredible white floor-length gown of some sort of flowing material and leaned in over the camera in the crib and simply apologized.
Question.
Apologized. As in my lines were various apologies. I'm so sorry. I'm so terribly sorry. I am so, so sorry. Please know how very, very, very sorry I am. For a real long time. I doubt he used it all. I strongly doubt he used it all. But there were at least 20 minutes of permutations of, I'm sorry.
Question.
Not exactly. Not exactly veiled.
Question.
The point of view was from the crib, yes. A crib's eye view. But that's not what I mean by driving the scene. The camera was fitted with a lens with something Jim called, I think, an auto wobble. Ocular wobble, something like that. A ball and socket joint behind the mount that made the lens wobble a little bit. It made a weird little tiny whirring noise, I recollect.
Question.
The mount's the barrel. The mount's what the elements of the lens are arranged in. This crib lens's mount projected out way farther than a conventional lens, but it wasn't near as big around as a catadioptric lens. It looked more like
an eye stalk or a night vision scope than a lens. Long and skinny and projecting, with his slight wobble. I don't know much about lenses beyond basic concepts like length and speed. Lenses were Jim's forte. This can't be much of a surprise. He always had a whole case full. He paid more attention to the lenses and lights than to the camera. His other son carried them in a special case. Leith was cameras. The son was lenses. Lenses, Jim said, were what he had to bring to the whole enterprise. Of filmmaking. Of himself. He made all his own. Question. Well, I've never been around them, but I know there's something wobbled and weird about their vision, supposedly. I think the newer born they are, the more they wobble. Plus, I think a milky blur. Neonatal nystagmus. I don't know where I heard that term. I don't remember. It could have been Jim. It could have been the sun. What I know about infants, personally, you could... It may have been an astigmatic lens. I don't think there's much doubt the lens was supposed to reproduce an infantile visual field. But that's what you could feel was driving the scene. My face wasn't important. You never got the sense it was meant to be captured realistically by this lens. Question. I never saw it. I've got no idea. Question. They were buried with him, the masters of everything unreleased. At least, that was in his will. Question. It had nothing to do with killing himself. Less than nothing to do with it. Question. No, I never saw his fucking will. He told me things. He'd stop being drunk all the time. That killed him. He couldn't take it, but he'd made a promise. Question. I don't know that he ever even got a finished master. That's your story. There wasn't anything unendurable or enslaving in either of my scenes. Nothing like these actual perfection rumors. These are academic rumors. He talked about making something, quote, too perfect, but as a joke. He had a thing about entertainment, being criticized about entertainment versus non-entertainment, and stasis. He used to refer to the work itself as entertainments. He always meant it ironically. Even in jokes, he never talked about an anti-aversion or antidote, for God's sake. He'd never carry it that far, a joke. When he talked about this thing as a, quote, perfect entertainment, terminally compelling, it was always ironic. He was having a sly little jab at me. I used to go around saying the veil was to disguise lethal perfection, that I was too lethally beautiful for people to stand. It was a kind of joke I'd gotten from one of his entertainments, the Medusa odalisk thing. That even in UHID I hid by hiddenness in denial about the deformity itself. So Jim took a failed piece and told me it was too perfect to release. It'd paralyze people. It was entirely clear that it was an ironic joke, to me. Question. Jim's humor was a dry humor. Question. If it got made and nobody's seen it, the master, it's in there with him, buried. That's just a guess, but I bet you. Call it an educated bet. Question. That's the part of the joke he didn't know. Where he's buried is itself buried now. It's in your annihilation zone. It's not even your territory. And now if you want the thing, he'd enjoy the joke very much, I think. Oh, shit, yes. Very much. By a rather creepy coincidence, it turned out that, up in our room, Kyle Dempsey, Coyle, and Mario were also watching one of himself's old efforts. Mario had gotten his pants on and was using his special tool to zip and button. Coyle looked oddly traumatized. He was sitting on the edge of my bed, his eyes wide and his whole body with the slight tremble of something hanging from the tip of a pipette. Mario greeted me by name. Snow continued to whirl and eddy outside the window. The position of the sun was impossible to gauge. The net posts were now buried almost up to their scorecard attachments. The wind was piling snow up in drifts against all Academy right angles, and then pummeling the drifts into unusual shapes. The window's whole view had the gray, grainy quality of a poor photo. The sky looked diseased. Mario worked his tool with great patience. It often took him several tries to catch and engage the tool's jaws on the tongue of his zipper. Coyle, still wearing his apnea mouthguard, stared at our room's little viewer. The cartridge was himself's accomplice, a short melodrama with Cosgrove Watt and a boy no one had ever seen before or since.
"You woke up early," Mario said, smiling up from his fly.
His bed was made up drum tight. I smiled. Turns out I wasn't the only one.
"You look sad."
I raised my hand with the NASA glass at Coyle. "An unexpected pleasure, KDC."
"Thith thick and meth," Coyle said.
I put the glass and toothbrush on my dresser and straightened its doily. I picked some clothing up and began separating it by smell into wearable and unwearable.
"Kyle says Jim Trolch tore some of Ortho's face off, trying to pull him off a window his face got glued to," Mario said. "And then Jim Trolch and Mr. Kinkle tried to put toilet tissue on the ripped parts, the way Tall Paul sometimes puts little bits of Kleenex on a shaving cut. But Ortho's face was a lot worse than a shaving cut, and they used a whole roll. And now Ortho's face is covered with toilet tissue. And the tissue's stuck now, and Ortho can't get it off. And at breakfast, Mr. DeLint was yelling at Ortho for letting them put toilet tissue on it. And Ortho ran to his and Kyle's room and locked the door, and Kyle doesn't have his key since the accident with the whirlpool."
I helped Mario on with his police locks vest and affixed the Velcro nice and tight. Mario's chest is so fragile-feeling that I could feel his heartbeats tremble through the vest and sweatshirt. Coyle removed the apnea guard. Strings of white, nighttime oral material appeared between his mouth and the guard as he extracted it. He looked to Mario.
"Tell him the worst part."
I was watching Coyle very closely to see what he planned to do with the sickening mouthpiece he held.
"Hey, Hal, your phone has messages, and Mike Pemulis came by and asked if you were up and about."
"You haven't told him the worst part of it," Coyle said.
"Don't even think about putting that thing down anywhere my bed, Kyle, please."
"I'm holding it away from everything, don't worry."
Mario used his tool to zip up the long curved zipper of his backpack.
"Kyle said there was a problem with a discharge again."
"So I heard," I said.
"And Kyle says he woke up and Ortho was missing, and Ortho's bed was missing as well, so he turned on the light."
Coyle gestured with the appliance.
"And lo and fucking capital B, behold!"
"Yes, and lo," Mario said. "Ortho's bed is up near the ceiling of their room. The frame has some way got lifted up and bolted to the ceiling, sometime during the night without Kyle hearing it or waking up."
"Until the discharge, that is," I said.
"This is it," said Coyle. "The tin cans and accusations I'm moving his stuff around are one thing. I'm going to lateral Alice for a switch like Trolch did. This is the straw."
Mario said, "And his bed's up on the ceiling now still. And if it falls, it's going to go right through the floor and fall in Graham and Petropolis's room."
"He's in there right now, all mummified in toilet paper, sulking, with his bed hanging overhead, with a door locked. So I can't even get my apnea guard cleaning supplies,"
Coyle said. I'd heard nothing about Trolch apparently switching room assignments with Trevor Axford. A gigantic wedge of snow slid down a steep part of the roof over our window and fell past the window and hit the ground below with a huge whoomp. For some reason, the fact that something as major as a midterm room switch could have taken place without my knowing anything about it filled me with dread. There were a few glitters of a possible, incipient panic attack again. Mario's bedside table had a tube of salve for his pelvis's burn, unevenly squeezed. Mario was looking at my face.
"Is it you're sad about not getting to play, if the Quebec players are canceled?"
"And then to crown off the whole night, he ends up with his face glued to a window," Coyle said disgustedly. Frozen, I corrected him. Except, but now listen to Stice's explanation.
Let me guess, I said.
For the bed hovering.
Mario looked at Coyle.
You said bolted.
I said presumably bolted is what I said. I said the only rationale that's possible is bolts.
Let me guess, I said.
Let him guess, Mario told Coyle.
The darkness thinks ghosts.
Coyle stood and came toward us. His two eyes were not set quite level in his face.
Stice's explanation that he swore me to discretion, but that was before the bed was on the ceiling, was he thinks he's been somehow selected or chosen to get haunted or possessed by some kind of beneficiary or guardian ghost that resides in and or manifests in ordinary physical objects, that wants to teach the darkness how to not underestimate ordinary objects and raise his game to, like, a supernatural level to help his game.
One eye was subtly lower than the other and set at a different angle.
Or hurt somebody else's, I said.
Stice is mentally buckling,
Coyle said, still moving in. I was careful to stay just out of morning breath range.
He keeps staring at things with his temple veins flexing, trying to exert will on them. He bet me 20 beans he could stand on his desk chair and lift it up at the same time. And then he wouldn't let me cancel the bet when I got embarrassed for him after half an hour, standing up there flexing his temples.
I was also keeping a careful eye on the oral appliance.
Did you guys hear sausage analog and fresh squeezed for breakfast?
Mario asked again if I were sad.
Coyle said, I was down there. Stice's map was taking the edge off appetites all over the room. Then DeLint started yelling at him.
He was looking at me oddly.
I don't see what's so funny about it, man.
Mario fell backward onto his bed and wriggled into his backpack's straps with practiced ease.
Coyle said, I don't know if I should go to Shtit, or Rusk, or what, or Lateral Alice. What if they haul him off somewhere, and it's my fault?
There's no denying the Dark's raised his game this fall, though. There are machine messages on the machine howl, too,
Mario said as I held his hands carefully and pulled him upright.
What if it's the mental buckling that's raised his game?
Coyle said.
Does it still count as buckling?
Cosgrove Watt had been one of the very few professional actors himself ever used. Himself often liked to use rank amateurs. He wanted them simply to read their lines with an amateur's wooden self-consciousness off cue cards. Mario or Disney Leith would hold up, well to the side of wherever the character was supposed to be looking. Up until the last phase of his career, himself had apparently thought the stilted wooden quality of non-professionals helped to strip away the pernicious illusion of realism, and to remind the audience that they were, in reality, watching actors acting, and not people behaving. Like the Parisian French Bresson he so admired, himself had no interest in succoring the audience with illusory realism, he said. The apparent irony of the fact that it required non-actors to achieve this stilted artificial I'm only acting here quality was one of very few things about himself's early projects that truly interested academic critics. But the real truth was that the early himself hadn't wanted skilled or believable acting to get in the way of the abstract ideas and technical innovations in the cartridges, and this had always seemed to me more like Brecht than like Bresson. Conceptual and technical ingenuity didn't much interest entertainment film audiences, though. And one way of looking at himself's abandonment of anti-confluentialism is that, in his last several projects, he'd been so desperate to make something that ordinary U.S. audiences might find entertaining and diverting and conducive to self-forgetting,
378,
that he had had professionals and amateurs alike emoting wildly all over the place. Getting emotion out of either actors or audiences had never struck me as one of himself's strengths, though I could remember arguments during which Mario had claimed I didn't see a lot of what was right there. Cosgrove Watt was a pro, but he wasn't very good. And before himself discovered him, Watt's career consisted mostly of regional market commercials on broadcast television. His widest commercial exposure was as the Dancing Gland in a series of spots for a chain of East Coast endocrinology clinics. He'd worn a bulbous white costume, white toupee, and either a ball and chain or white tap shoes, depending on whether he was portraying the before gland or the after gland. Himself, during one of these commercials, had shouted Eureka at our HD Sony, and traveled personally all the way to Glen Riddle, Pennsylvania, where Watt lived with his mother and her cats, to recruit him. He used Cosgrove Watt in almost every project for 18 months. Watt, for a time, was to himself, as De Niro was to Scorsese, McLaughlin to Lynch, Allen to Allen. And up until Watt's temporal lobe problem made his social presence unbearable, himself had actually put Watt, mother and cats, up in a contiguous suite of what later became prorector's rooms off the main ETA tunnel, the moms acquiescing in this, but instructing Oren, Mario, and me never, ever to remain in a room alone with Watt. Accomplice was one of Watt's later roles. It was a sad and simple cartridge, and so short that the TP retracted to the film's beginning in almost no time. Himself's film opens as a beautiful, sad, young bus station male prostitute, fragile and epicene, and so blonde even his eyebrows and lashes are blonde, is approached in the Greyhound coffee shop by a flabby, dissipated-looking old specimen, with gray teeth and circumflex eyebrows and obvious temporal lobe difficulties. Cosgrove Watt plays the depraved older man, who takes the boy home to his lush, but somehow scuzzy, co-op apartment. In fact, the place himself had rented for O, and the PGOAT, and had decorated in various gradations of scuzz for the interiors of almost all his late projects. The sad and beautiful Aryan-looking boy agrees to seduction by the dissipated old specimen, but only on the condition that the man wear protection. The boy, who is inarticulate, nevertheless makes this stipulation extremely clear. Safe sex or no sex, he stipulates, holding up a familiar foil packet. The hideous old specimen, now in a smoking jacket and ascot of apricot-colored silk, and smoking through a long white FDR-style filter, is offended, thinks the young male prostitute has sized him up as such a depraved and dissipated old specimen that he might well have it, the human immunovirus, he thinks. His thoughts are rendered via animated thought bubbles, which himself, at that late middle stage, hoped the audience would find at once self-consciously non-illusory and wildly entertaining. Watt's old specimen is grinning grayly in what he thinks is a pleasant way, as he obligingly takes the foil packet and removes his ascot with what he believes to be a sensual flourish. But inside his thought bubble, he's having temporal lobe spasms of sadistic rage at the sad blonde boy for appearing to size him up as a health risk. The obvious health risk here is referred to, both orally and in the thought bubble, merely as it. For example, little bastard thinks I'm so dissipated looking that I've been at this sort of thing so long that I'm likely to have it, does he? The old specimen thinks, his thought bubble going all jagged with rage. So the flabby old specimens now, at only 6 minutes into the cartridge, track 510, he's now taking the sad, beautiful boy in the standard, extravagantly hunched, homosexual way on the canopied bed of his tacky boudoir. The young male prostitutes dutifully assumed the hunched, homo-submissive position because the old ponce has showed him he's wearing the condom. The young prostitute, who's shown, hunched, only from the left side during the act itself, seems beautiful in a fragile, skinny-flanked, visible ribs way, while the old specimen has the slack ass and pointy little breasts of a man made grotesque by years of dissipation. The intercourse scene is done under bright lamps without any sort of soft focus or light jazz background score to lighten the atmosphere of clinical detachment. What the sad blonde submissive boy doesn't know is that the dissipated old specimen had secretly palmed an old-fashioned, one sharp-sided razor blade when he'd gone into his burgundy-tiled bathroom to gargle with cinnamon mouthwash and dab Calvin Klein brand pheromonic musk on his flabby pulse points. And as he hunches animalistically over the boy, he's holding the business end of the blade right up next to the sad boy's anus as he takes his pleasure, so that the blade's sharp side slices in two both condom and erect phallus on each outthrust. The hideous old specimen, unmindful of the blood and whatever pains involved in the phallic slicing, as, still hunched and thrusting, he peels the slit condom off like the skin of a sausage. The young male prostitute, hunched submissively, feels the condom peel, and then the blood, and starts struggling like a condemned man, trying to get the condomless, bleeding, flabby old specimen out and off of him. But the boy's thin and delicate, and the old man has no trouble holding him down with his soft, slack, flabby weight until he's grimaced and grunted and taken his pleasure to its end. It's apparently an explicit homosexual sex scene convention that whoever takes the submissive hunched position keeps his face turned away from the camera while the dominant partner's phallus is inside him, and himself honors this convention, though a self-conscious footnote subtitled along the bottom of the screen rather irritatingly points out that the scene is honoring a convention. The prostitute turns his agonized face around to the camera only after the depraved older homosexual has removed his bloody and deflating post-pleasure phallus, brings his blonde-browed face around to his left to face the audience in a mute howl as he collapses onto his delicate chest with his arms out on the satin sheets and his violated bum hiked high in the air, revealing now, at the crease of his bum and upper hamstring, a vivid purple splotch, more vivid than any bruise, and with 8 spidery tentacles radiating from it that are, the older man's horrified thought bubble reveals, the unmistakable 8-legged vivid contusion blotch sign of Kaposi's sarcoma, that most universal symptom of it. And the boy is sobbing that the depraved old homosexual has made him, the prostitute, a murderer. The boy's racking sobs making the hiked bum waggle in front of the old specimen's horrified face, as the boy sobs into the chartreuse satin and shrieks, "Murderer! Murderer!" over and over, so that almost a third of accomplice's total length is devoted to the racked repetition of this word. Way longer than is needed for the audience to absorb the twist and all its possible implications and meanings. This was just the sort of issue Mario and I argued about. As I see it, even though the cartridge's end has both characters emoting out of every pore, Accomplice's essential project remains abstract and self-reflexive. We end up feeling and thinking not about the characters, but about the cartridge itself. By the time the final repetitive image darkens to a silhouette and the credits roll against it, and the old man's face stops spasming in horror, and the boy shuts up, the cartridge's real tension becomes the question, did himself subject us to 500 seconds of the repeated cry, "Murderer," for some reason? I.e., is the puzzlement, and then boredom, and then impatience, and then excruciation, and then near rage, aroused in the film's audience by the static repetitive final one-third of the film, aroused for some theoretical aesthetic end? Or is himself simply an amazingly shitty editor of his own stuff? It was only after himself's death that critics and theorists started to treat this question as potentially important. A woman at UCal Irvine had earned tenure with an essay arguing that the reason versus no reason debate about what was unentertaining in himself's work illuminated the central conundrum of millennial après-garde film, most of which, in the telepeter age of home-only entertainment, involved the question, why so much aesthetically ambitious film was so boring, and why so much shitty reductive commercial entertainment was so much fun. The essay was turgid to the point of being unreadable, besides using reference as a verb, and pluralizing conundrum as conundra.
379.
From a horizontal position on the bedroom floor, I could use the TP's remote to do everything but actually remove and insert cartridges into the drive's dock. The room's window was now a translucent clot of snow and steam. Interlace's spontaneous disseminations for New England were all about weather. With our subscription system, ETA got numerous large market spontaneous tracks. Each track took a slightly different angle on the weather. Each track had a slightly different focus. Remote reports from Boston's North and South Shores, Providence, New Haven, and Hartford, Springfield, served to establish a consensus that a terrific amount of snow had fallen and was continuing to fall and blow around and pile up. Cars were shown abandoned at hasty angles, and we got to see the universal white VW bug shape of snow-buried cars. Black-helmeted gangs of adolescents on snowmobiles were shown prowling New Haven streets, clearly up to no good. Pedestrians were shown bent over and floundering. Remote report journalists were shown trying to flounder over to them to get their thoughts and reflections. One floundering reporter in Quincy, on the South Shore, abruptly disappeared from view except for a hand with a microphone protruding bravely from some sort of sinkhole of snow. The bent backs of technicians were then shown floundering away from the remote camera to his aid. People with snowblowers stood in their own little blizzards. A pedestrian was filmed doing a spectacular pratfall. Cars at all angles and streets were shown with their tires spinning, shuddering in stasis. One track kept cutting back to a man endlessly trying to brush off a windshield that immediately whitened again behind each brushstroke. A bus sat with its snout in a monster-sized drift. ATH SCME fans atop the wall north of Ticonderoga, New York, were shown making horizontal cyclones of snow in the air. Rouged, somber women in Interlace Studios concurred that this was the worst blizzard to hit the region since BS 1998, and the second worst since BS 1993. A man in a wheelchair was shown staring stonily at a 2-meter drift across the ramp outside the statehouse. Satellite maps of East Central ONAN showed a white formation that was spiraled and shaggy and seemed to have what looked like claws. It was not a nor'easter, a hot, moist ridge from the Gulf of Mexico, and an Arctic cold front had collided over the concavity. The storm's satellite photo was superimposed on schemata of the 98 ass kicker and shown to be just about identical. An unwelcome old acquaintance was back, a striking woman with black bangs and vivid lipstick said, smiling somberly. Another track iterated, "This was not a nor'easter." It might have been better to say, "smiling mirthlessly." The flat, glazed eyes of the man brushing impotently at his windshield seemed to represent an important visual image. Different tracks kept returning to his face. He refused to acknowledge journalists or requests for thoughts. His was the creepy businesslike face of someone carefully picking up glass in the road after an accident in which his decapitated wife's been impaled on the steering wheel. Another track's anchor was a beautiful black woman with purple lipstick and what looked like a very tall crew cut. Reports of snow came in from all directions. After a while, I stopped keeping track of the number of times the word snow was repeated. All synonyms for snowstorm were rapidly exhausted. Helmetless thrill-seekers on snowmobiles were doing donuts in Copley Square downtown. Homeless men hunched, nearly drift-covered in doorways, readying snorkels of rolled-up newspaper. Jim Trolch, now apparently a resident of B-204, had liked to do a pretty funny impression of an Interlace anchorwoman having an orgasm. One of the thrill-seekers' snowmobiles spun out of control and plunged into a drift, and the remote camera stayed on the drift for several moments, but nothing emerged. Connecticut's National Guard Reserve had been ordered to assemble, but had not assembled because travel in Connecticut was impossible. 3 men in uniforms and gray helmets chased 2 men in white helmets, all on snowmobiles, for reasons an on-site journalist described as not yet emergent. Remote site journalists used such words as emergent, individual, alleged, utilize, and developing. But all this impersonal diction was preceded by the anchor person's first name, as if the report were part of an intimate conversation. An Interlace delivery boy was shown delivering recorded cartridges on a snowmobile and was described as plucky. Otis B. Lord had undergone a procedure for the removal of the Hitachi monitor on Thursday, Lamont Shue had said. I had never once ridden a snowmobile, skied or skated. ETA discouraged them. DeLint described winter sports as practically getting down on one knee and begging for an injury. The The snowmobiles on the viewer all made sounds like little chainsaws that were extra pugnacious to compensate for being so little. There was a poignant shot of a stuck plow in Northampton. Individuals who are not with emergency reasons to travel, sick, were being officially discouraged from traveling by a state trooper in a hat with a chin strap. A Brockton man in a Land's End parka took a fall too burlesque to have been unstaged. I could barely recall the 98 blizzard. The academy had been open for only a few months. I remember the edges of the shaved hilltop were still square and steep and striped in sedimentary layers, final construction delayed by some nasty piece of litigation from the VA hospital below. The storm came barreling in southeast from Canada in March. Dwight, Flechette, and Oren, and the other players, had to be led to the lung, roped together, single file, Stitt in the lead, carrying a highway flare. A couple photos hung in CT's waiting room. The last boy along the rope disappeared into a forlorn gray whirl. The lung's new bubble, and had to be taken down and fixed when Snow White stove it in on one side. The T stopped running. I remember some of the younger players had cried and sworn up and down that the blizzard wasn't their fault. For days, snow churned steadily out of a graphite sky. Himself had sat in a spindle-backed chair at the same living room window CT now uses for advanced worry, and aimed a series of non-digital cameras at the mounting snow. After years in which his consuming obsession was the establishment of ETA, Oren said. Himself had started in with the film obsession almost immediately after the Academy was up and running. Oren has said the moms had assumed the film thing was a passing obsession. Himself had seemed interested mostly in the lenses and rasters at first.
380.
And in the consequences of their modification. He sat in that chair throughout the whole storm, sipping brandy from a one-handed snifter, his long legs not quite covered by a plaid blanket. His legs had seemed to me almost endlessly long back then. He always seemed to be right on the edge of coming down with something. His record, up until then, indicated that he remained obsessed with something until he became successful at it, then transferred his obsession to something else. From military optics, to annular optics, to entrepreneurial optics, to tennis pedagogy, to film. In the chair during the blizzard, he'd had beside him several different types of camera and a large leather case. The inside of the case was striated, with lenses down both sides. He used to let Mario and me put different lenses in our eyes and squint to hold them, imitating Stitt. One way of looking at the film obsession's endurance is that himself was never really successful or accomplished at filmmaking. This was something else on which Mario and I had agreed to disagree. It took almost a year to complete the move from Weston to ETA. The moms had attachments in Weston, and she drew things out. I was pretty small. I lay flat on my back on our room's carpet and tried to recall details of our home in Weston, twiddling the TP's remote with my thumb. I do not have Mario's head for remembered detail. One dissemination track simply panned the Metro Boston sky and horizons from atop the Hancock Tower. On the FM band, WYYY was apparently doing its weather report via mimesis, broadcasting raw static, while the student staff doubtless did bongs in celebration of the storm, and then went up, sliding around the Union's cerebral rooftop. The Hancock camera's pan included the sinciput of the MIT Union, its roof's convolutions filling with snow ahead of the rest of it, creepy filigrees of white against the roof's deep gray. Our sub-dorm room's only carpet was an oversized corruption of the carpet page from the Lindisfarne Gospels, in which you had to look very closely to make out the tiny pornographic scenes in the Byzantine weave surrounding the cross. I'd acquired the carpet years ago, during a period of intense interest in Byzantine pornography, inspired by what I'd seen as a titillating reference in the OED. I, too, had moved serially between obsessions as a child. I adjusted my angle on the carpet. I was trying to align myself along some sort of grain in the world I could barely feel since Pemulus and I stopped. meaning the grain, not the world. I realized I could not distinguish my own visual memories of the Weston house from my memories of hearing Mario's detailed reports of his memories. I remember a late Victorian three-level on a low, quiet street of elms, hyper-fertilized lawns, tall homes with oval windows and screen porches. One of the street's homes had a pineapple finial. Only the street itself was low. The lots were humped up high and the houses so tall, the broad street seemed nevertheless constricted, a sort of affluence-flanked defile. It seemed always to be summer or spring. I could remember the mom's voice high overhead at a screen porch door, calling us in as dusk drifted down, and leaded fanlights began to light up at home's doors in some sort of linear sync. Either our driveway or another driveway, flanked with whitewashed stones the shapes of beads or drops. The mom's intricate garden, in a backyard enclosed by a fencework of trees. Himself on the screen porch, stirring a gin and tonic with his finger. The mom's dog, S. Johnson, not yet neutered, confined by psychosis in a sort of large fenced pen, abutting the garage, running around and around the pen when thunder sounded. The smell of Noxzema. Himself behind Orin in the upstairs bathroom, towering over and down, teaching Orin to shave against the grain, upward. I remember S. Johnson leaping up on his hind legs and sort of playing the fence with his paws as Mario approached the pen. The rattling chain link's pitch. The circle of earth worn bare by S.J.'s orbit in the pen when thunder sounded or planes crossed overhead. Himself sat low in chairs and could cross his legs and still have both feet flat on the floor. He held his chin in his hand while he looked at you. My memories of Weston seemed like tableaus. They seemed more like snapshots than films. A weird isolated memory of summertime gnats knitting the air above the shaggy animal head of a neighbor's topiary hedge. Our own round shrubs trimmed flat as tabletops by the moms. More horizontals. The chatter of hedge clippers, their power cords bright orange. I had to swallow spit with almost every breath. I remembered climbing with a dawdler's heavy tread, the cement steps up from the street to a gambrel-roofed late Victorian, whose narrow height from the steps gave it the distended look of thick liquid hanging. Gingerbread eaves, undulate shingles of weathered red, zinc gutters the mom's graduate students came and kept clean. A blue star in the front window and the words Block Mother, which had always suggested either a rectangular woman or some type of football crowd cheer. The inside cool and dim, and a smell of lemon pledge. I had no visual memories of my mother without white hair. All that varied was the length. A touch-tone phone with a cord running into the wall, on a horizontal surface, and a recessed alcove near the front door. Cork floors and pre-mounted shelving of woody-smelling wood. The chilling frame print of Lang directing Metropolis in 1924.
381.
A hulking black chest with strap hinges of brass. A few of himself's old heavy tennis trophies as bookends on the mounted shelving. An etagere filled with old-fashioned magnetic videos and bright adverting boxes. A cluster of blue and white delts on the etagere's top shelf that had dwindled as one figurine after another got knocked off by Mario, stumbling or shoved. The blue-white chairs with the protective plastic that made your legs sweat. A divan done in some sort of burlap-esque Iranian wool dyed to the color of sand mixed with ash. This may have been a neighbor's divan. Some cigarette burns in the fabric of the divan's arms. Books, videotapes, kitchen's cans, all alphabetized. Everything painfully clean. Several spindle-backed captain's chairs in contrasting fruit woods. A surreal memory of a steamed lavatory mirror with a knife sticking out of the pane. A massive stereo television console, of whose gray-green eye I was afraid when the television was off. Some of the memories have to be confabulated or dreamed. The moms would never have had a divan with burns in it. A picture window east, the direction of Boston, with claret-colored figures, and a blue sun all suspended in a web of lead. A candy-colored summer sunrise through that window as I watched television in the AM. The tall, thin, quiet man, himself, with his razor burn, and bent glasses and chinos too short, whose neck was slender and shoulder sloped, who slumped in candied east window sunlight, with his tailbone supported by window sills, meekly stirring a glass of something with his finger, while the mom stood there telling him she'd long since abandoned any reasonable hope that he could hear what she was telling him. This silent figure, of whom I still remember mostly endless legs and the smell of Noxzema shave cream, seems still impossible to reconcile with the sensibility of something like accomplice. It was impossible to imagine himself conceiving of sodomy and razors, no matter how theoretically. I lay there, and could almost remember Oren telling me something almost moving that himself had once told him. Something to do with accomplice. The memory hung somewhere just out of conscious reach, and its tip-of-the-tongue inaccessibility felt too much like the preface to another attack. I accepted it. I could not remember. Off down the Weston Street, a church with an announcement board in the grass out front, white plastic letters on a slotted black surface. And at least once, Mario and I stood watching a goatish man change the letters, and thus the announcement. One of the first occasions where I remember reading something involved the announcement board announcing, "Life is like tennis. Those who serve best usually win." With the letters all spaced far out like that. A big, fresh, cement-colored church. Liberal with glass, denomination not recalled, but built in what was, in the B.S. 80s probably, modern. A parabolic, poured concrete shape, billowed and peaked like a cresting wave. A suggestion in it of some paranormal wind somewhere that could make concrete billow and pop like a tucking sail. Our own sub-dorm room now has three of those old Weston captain's chairs whose backs dent your spine if you don't fit it carefully between two spindles. We have an unused wicker basket for laundry on which are stacked some corduroy spectation pillows. Floor plans for Hagia Sophia and St. Simeon at Kalatziman on the wall over my bed. The really prurient part of consummation of the leverets over the chairs, also from the old interest in Byzantinalia. Something about the stiff and dismantled quality of many-era Greca porn, people broken into pieces and trying to join, etc. At the foot of Mario's bed, a surplus store trunk for his own film equipment, and a canvas director's chair where he's always laid out his police lock, lead weights, and vest for the night. A fiberboard stand for the compact teepee and viewer, and a stenographer's chair for using the teepee to type. Five total chairs in a room where no one ever sits in a chair. As in all the sub-dorm rooms and hallways, a guilloche ran around our walls half a meter from the ceiling. New ETAs always drove themselves bats, counting their rooms' guilloches interwoven circles. Our room had 811, and truncated bits of 12 and 13, two left halves stuck like open parentheses up in the southwest corner. Between the ages of 11 and 13, I'd had a plaster knockoff of a lewd Constantine Frieze, the emperor with a hyperemic organ and an impure expression, hung by two hooks from the guilloche's lower border. Now I couldn't for the life of me recall what I'd done with the frieze, or which Byzantine seraglio the original had decorated. There had been a time when data like these were instantly available. The Weston living room had had an early version of himself's full-spectrum cove lighting, and at one end an elevated fieldstone fireplace with a big copper hood that made a wonderful ear-splitting drumhead for wooden spoons, with memories of some foreign adult I didn't recognize grinding at her temples and pleading, "Do stop." The mom's jungle of green babies had spread out into the room from another corner. The plants' pots, on stands of various heights, hanging in nests of twine suspended from clamps, arrayed at eye height from projecting trellises of white painted iron, all in the otherworldly glow of a
white-hooded tube of ultraviolet light hung with thin chains from the ceiling. Mario can recall violet-lit laces of ferns and the wet, meaty gloss of rubber tree leaves, and a coffee table of green-shot black marble, too heavy to move, on whose corner Mario knocked out a tooth after what Orin swore up and down was an accidental shove. Mrs. Clark's variocotic calves at the stove, the way her mouth overhead would disappear when the moms reorganized something in the kitchen. My eating mold, and the moms' being very upset that I'd eaten it. This memory was of Orin's telling the story. I had no childhood memory of eating fungus. My trusty NASA glass still rested on my chest, rising when my ribcage rose. When I looked down my own length, the glass's round mouth was a narrow slot. This was because of my optical perspective. There was a concise term for optical perspective that I, again, could not quite make resolve. What made it hard really to recall our old house's living room was that so many of its appointments were now in the living room of the headmaster's house, the same and yet altered, and by more than rearrangement. The onyx coffee table Mario had fallen against. Specular is what refers to optical perspective. It came to me after I stopped trying to recall it. Now supported compact discs and tennis magazines and a cello-shaped vase of dried eucalyptus and the red steel stand for the family Xmas tree when in season. The table had been a wedding gift from himself's mother, who died of emphysema shortly before Mario's surprise birth. Orin reports she'd looked like an embalmed poodle, all neck tendons and tight white curls and eyes that were all pupil. The Moms' birth mother had died in Quebec of an infarction when she, the Moms, was 8. Her father, during her sophomore year at McGill under circumstances none of us knew. The hydrant-sized Mrs. Tavis was still alive and somewhere in Alberta, the original Lillet potato farm now part of the Great Concavity and forever lost. Orin and Bain, among others, at family trivia during that terrible first year's blizzard, Orin imitating the Moms' high breathy, "My son ate this, God, please," never tiring of it. Orin had liked also to recreate for us the spooky, kyphotic hunch of himself's mother in her wheelchair, beckoning him closer with a claw, the way she seemed always caved in, over and around her chest, as if she'd been speared there. An air of deep dehydration had hung about her, he said, as if she osmosized moisture from whoever came near. She spent her last few years living in the Marlborough Street brownstone they'd had before Mario and I were born, tended by a gerontologic nurse, Orin said always wore the expression of every post office mugshot you've ever seen. When the nurse was off, a small silver bell was apparently hung from an arm of the old lady's wheelchair, to be rung when she could not breathe. A cherry silver tinkle announcing asphyxiation upstairs. Mrs. Clark would still pale whenever Mario asked about her. It's become easier to see the climacteric changes in the Moms' own body since she began confining herself more and more to the headmaster's house. This occurred after himself's funeral, but in stages. The gradual withdrawal and reluctance to leave the grounds, and the signs of aging. It is hard to notice what you see every day. None of the physical changes has been dramatic. Her nerved-up dancer's legs becoming hard, stringy, a shrinking of the hips and a girdly thickening at the waist. Her face settles a little lower on her skull than it did 4 years ago, with a slight bunching under the chin and an emerging potential for something pruny happening around her mouth. In time, I thought I could see. The word that best connoted why the glass's mouth looked slotty was probably foreshortened. The QRS infantilist would no doubt join the old grief therapist in asking how watching one's moms begin to age makes you feel inside. Questions like these become almost koans. You have to lie when the truth is nothing at all, since this appears as a textbook lie under the therapeutic model. The brutal questions are the ones that force you to lie. Either our old kitchen or a neighbor's kitchen, paneled with walnut and hung with copper pate molds and herbal sprigs. An unidentified woman, not Avril or Mrs. Clark, standing in that kitchen in snug cherry slacks, loafers over bare feet, waggling a mixing spoon, laughing at something,
a long-tailed comet of flower on her cheek. It occurred to me then, with some force, that I didn't want to play this afternoon, even if some sort of indoor exhibition meet came off. Not even neutral, I realized, I would, on the whole, have preferred not to play. What Stitt might have to say to that versus what Lyle would say? I was unable to stay with the thought long enough to imagine himself's response to my refusal to play, if any. But this was the man who made Accomplice, whose sensibility informed the hetero-hardcore Mobius strips and the sado-periodontal Fun with Teeth and several other projects that were just thoroughgoingly nasty and sick. Then it occurred to me that I could walk outside and contrive to take a spill, or squeeze out the window on the rear staircase of HMH and fall several meters to the steep embankment below, being sure to land on the bad ankle and hurt it so I'd not have to play. That I could carefully plan out a fall from the court's observation transom or the spectators' gallery of whatever club CT and the moms sent us to help raise funds, and fall so carefully, badly, I'd take out all the ankle's ligaments and never play again. Never have to. Never get to. I could be the faultless victim of a freak accident and be knocked from the game while still on the ascendant, becoming the object of compassionate sorrow rather than disappointed sorrow. I couldn't stay with this fantastic line of thought long enough to parse out whose disappointment I was willing to cripple myself to avoid, or forego. And then, out of nowhere, it returned to me. The moving thing himself had said to Oren. This was concerning adult films, which, from what I've seen, are too downright sad to be truly nasty, or even really entertainment, though the adjective adult is kind of a misnomer. Orne had told me that once he and Smothergill, Fletchett, and I think Penn's older brother had gotten hold of a magnetic video of some old hardcore X-film. The Green Door, or Deep Throat. One of those old chestnuts of cellulite and jism. There were excited plans to convene in VR3 and watch the thing in secret after lights out. The viewing rooms at that point had broadcast televisions and magnetic VCR devices, instructional magvids from Galloway and Braden, etc. Oren and company were all around 15 at the time, bombed by their own glands. They were pop-eyed at the prospect of genuine porn. There were rules about video's suitability for viewing in the honor code, but himself was not noted for his discipline, and Stitt didn't yet have DeLint. The first generation of ETAs did pretty much as they pleased off-court, as long as they were discreet. Nevertheless, word about this adult film got around, and somebody, probably Mary Esther Thode's sister Ruth, then a senior and insufferable, ratted the boys' viewing plans out to Stitt, who took the matter to himself. Oren said he was the only one himself called into the headmaster's office, which, in that era, had only one door, which himself asked Oren to close. Oren recalled seeing none of the unease that always accompanied himself's attempts at stern discipline. Instead, himself invited Oren to sit and gave him a lemon soda and stood facing him, leaning back slightly so that the front edge of his desk supported him at the tailbone. Himself took his glasses off and massaged his closed eyes delicately, almost treasuringly his old eyeballs, in the way Oren knew signified that himself was ruminative and sad. One or two soft interrogatives brought the whole affair out in the open. You could never lie to himself. Somehow you just never had the heart. Whereas Oren made almost an Olympic sport of lying to the moms. Anyway, Oren quickly confessed to everything. What himself said then moved him, Oren told me. Himself told Oren he wasn't going to forbid them to watch the thing if they really wanted to, but just, please, to keep it discreet. Just Bane and Smothergill and Oren's immediate circle, nobody younger, and nobody whose parents might hear about it. And for God's sake, don't let your mother get wind. But that Oren was old enough to make his own entertainment decisions, and if he decided he wanted to watch the thing, and so on. But himself said that if Oren wanted his personal, fatherly, as opposed to headmasterly, take on it, then he, Oren's father, though he wouldn't forbid it, would rather Oren didn't watch a hard porn film yet. He said this with such reticent earnestness. There was no way Orin couldn't ask him how come. Himself felt his jaw and pushed his glasses up several times and shrugged and finally said he supposed he was afraid of the film giving Orin the wrong idea about having sex. He said he'd personally prefer that Orin wait until he'd found someone he loved enough to want to have sex with and had had sex with this person, that he'd wait until he'd experienced for himself what a profound and really quite moving thing sex could be before he watched a film where sex was presented as nothing more than organs going in and out of other organs, emotionless, terribly lonely. He said he supposed he was afraid that something like The Green Door would give Orin an impoverished, lonely idea of sexuality. What poor old O claimed to have found so moving was himself's assumption that O was still chary. What moved me to feel sorry for Orin was that it seemed pretty obvious that that had nothing to do with what himself was trying to talk about. It was the most open I'd ever heard of himself being with anybody, and it seemed terribly sad to me somehow that he'd wasted it on Orin. I never once had a conversation nearly that open or intimate with himself. My most intimate memory of himself was the scratchiness of his jaw and the smell of his neck when I fell asleep at supper and he carried me upstairs to bed. His neck was thin but had a good meaty warm smell. I now for some reason associate it with the odor of Coach Schitt's pipe. I tried, briefly, to picture Ortho Stice hoisting his bunk up and bolting it to the ceiling without waking Coyle. Our room's door remained ajar from Mario's exit with Coyle to find someone with a master key. Yardguard and Vaganecht's heads popped in briefly and urged me to come have a look at the darkness's ruined map and withdrew when they got no response. The second floor was pretty quiet. Most of them were still dawdling at breakfast, awaiting some announcement on the weather and Quebecois squads. Snow hit the windows with a gritty sound. The angle of the wind had made a kind of whistle out of one corner of the subdorm building, and the whistling came and went. But then I heard John Wayne stride in the hall outside, light and even and easy on floors, the stride of a guy with stellar calf development. I heard his low sigh. Then, though the door was too far behind me to see, for a moment or two, I could somehow tell for sure that John Wayne's head was inside the open door. I could feel it, clearly, almost painfully. He was looking down at me, lying there on the Lindisfarne carpet. There was none of the gathering tension of a person deciding whether or not to speak. I could feel my throat's equipment move when I swallowed. John Wayne and I never had much to say to one another. There wasn't even hostility between us. He ate dinner with us at HMH every so often because he and the moms were tight. The moms made little attempt to disguise her attachment to Wayne. Now his breathing behind me was light and very even. No waste. Complete utilization of each breath.
382.
Of us three, it was Mario who had spent the most time with himself, sometimes traveling with him for location work. I had no idea what they spoke about together, or how openly. None of us had ever pressed Mario to say much about it. It occurred to me to wonder why this was so. I decided to get up, but then did not, in fact, get up. Orin was convinced that himself was a virgin when he met the moms in his late 30s. I found this pretty hard to believe. Orin will also grant that there's no doubt himself was faithful to the moms right up to the end, that his attachment to Orin's fiancée was not sexual. I had a sudden and lucid vision of the moms and John Wayne locked in a sexual embrace of some kind. John Wayne had been involved with the moms sexually since roughly the second month after his arrival. They were both expatriates. I hadn't yet been able to identify a strong feeling, one way or the other, about the liaison, nor about Wayne himself, except for admiring his talent and total focus. I did not know whether Mario knew of the liaison, to say nothing of poor C.T. It was impossible for me to imagine himself and the moms being explicitly sexual together. I bet most children have this difficulty, where their parents are concerned.
Sex between the moms and CT, I imagine, is both frenetic and weary, with a kind of doomed, timeless Faulknerian feel to it. I imagined the moms' eyes open and staring blankly at the ceiling the whole time. I imagined CT never once shutting up, talking around and around whatever was taking place between them. My coccyx had gone numb from the pressure of the floor through the thin carpet. Bane, graduate students, grammatical colleagues, Japanese fight choreographers, the hairy-shouldered Ken N. Johnson, the Islamic MD himself had found so especially torturing, these encounters were imaginable, but somehow generic. Mostly a matter of athleticism and flexibility, different configurations of limbs, the mood one more of cooperation than complicity or passion. I tended to imagine the moms staring expressionlessly at ceilings throughout. The complicit passion would have come after, probably, with her need to be sure the encounter was hidden. Peterson allusions notwithstanding, I wondered about some hazy connection between this passion for hiddenness and the fact that himself had made so many films titled Cage, and that the amateur player he became so attached to was the veiled girl, Oren's love. I wondered whether it was possible to lie supine and throw up without aspirating vomit or choking. The plumed spout of a whale. The tableau of John Wayne and my mother in my imagination was not very erotic. The image was complete and sharply focused, but seemed stilted, as if composed. She reclines against four pillows at an angle between seated and supine, staring upward, motionless and pale. Wayne, slim and brown-limbed, smoothly muscled, also completely motionless, lies over her, his untanned bottom in the air, his black, narrow face between her breasts, his eyes unblinking and his thin tongue out.